What vitiates entirely the socialist economic critique of capitalism is their failure to grasp the sovereignty of the consumers in the market economy. Welcome to Keith Knight. Don't tread on anyone. Today we have Mr. David D. Friedman. We will be discussing his book, Legal Systems, Very Different from Ours. Mr. Friedman, where's the best place to purchase the book?
You can get the Kindle or the paperback from Amazon, and you can also get the audiobook from Amazon or from Audible.
Excellent. Links will be in the description below on all platforms. Mr. Friedman, what is the purpose of a legal system?
I guess to settle conflicts among people's actions would be the closest statement. It is some way so that when I want to do something, you don't want me to do it, we have some hopefully peaceful way of settling the question.
What is the best evidence that you have that people can settle conflicts between themselves in the absence of a coercively funded monopoly or a state?
The fact that there have been, first, the fact that in modern societies, many of the ways in which we settle disputes do not involve any coercively funded monopoly. That, for example, when the two kids of my present marriage were young, our daughter did not want her brother coming into her room without her permission. She could enforce that because she was the older, with the result that he wanted to play with her more than she wanted to play with him. And she could therefore use the threat to withhold her attention as a way of enforcing her desires successfully. And the sign, they're both adults at this point, but the sign she hung on her door telling him not to come in is still there. But that would be a simple example. But to go to the question of where there is no framework of a coercive monopoly, the answer is that there are a variety of relatively primitive societies, more primitive than ours at least, in which you had stateless orders of different sorts. And they're really, well, I'm not sure that there are any I know much about where there is no overarching state, but there are ones where the control isn't really being done by the state. So if you think, say, of the Amish, Amish are basically unwilling to charge each other with crimes or to sue each other. They disapprove of that. So they have their own mechanisms for enforcing, for settling disputes among themselves. And the ultimate sanction in those mechanisms is ostracism. That if you don't go along with the rules for long enough, through enough repeated attempts to get you to do so, then the clergy of the congregation announces that you are now ostracized, Meidung, and that means that other members of the congregation and probably other Amish as well will associate with you only in a very limited fashion. And that's a serious cost. It's enough of a cost so that most of the time the system works. So that would be a modern example in modern day America. But people like the Somalians, the northern Somalians, people in Somaliland or the Bedouins would be examples of societies where there's nothing we would recognize as a state. Now, that doesn't mean there was no coercion, that in the systems we know about, there was always sort of backing at the threat that under some circumstances somebody would attack you. And it was rather a way of controlling that so that the normal result was a peaceful settlement rather than the normal result being people killing each other. But people killing each other did happen, of course, as it happens in our society. It was just that was when the system broke down, in effect. One of those systems that I know best is Saga period Iceland. And I'm a little reluctant to call it stateless because that society had a legal code, a legislature, and a court system. What it did not have was a state to enforce the verdicts. So whether you count, I usually refer to that as semi-stateless, whether you count that as a state is sort of up to you. But that meant that the mechanism for enforcing the verdicts was basically the threat of violent force by other people. and the court system and the legislature and the law code were ways of controlling that threat so that ordinarily it was clear who was in the right and who was in the wrong. And most of the time, if you were in the wrong, you backed down and you paid the damages you were supposed to pay. Sometimes you didn't, of course, as in our system.
All excellent points. Yeah, I never am in a conflict with someone and say, you know, I really need the state to intervene to really smooth things over. Even when a cop wrote me a fake ticket for waking in a non-wake zone, it's so much easier just to get rid of them than to go through the coercively funded court system. One of the major hurdles that comes up when discussing legal systems that are very different from ours is, well, any that involves non-state participation would include me having to pay fees, and I might be poor. That's why I committed crime, and I might not have the money. What confidence do you have that in a stateless society, people would be able to afford and still have access to legal services in the absence of a state?
Yeah, well, to begin with, of course, in our current state society, legal services are not free. That if you want to invoke this, that is, legal services where the government is going after somebody for doing something the government disapproves of are free for everybody except the person they're going after and the taxpayers, of course. But if I complain about something you're doing and want to use the law against it, I have to hire a lawyer. I may have to pay court fees, so that's not costless either. And in the historical societies that I know about, it wasn't really a matter of paying somebody for the service. It was a matter of having allies and friends and relatives and doing things yourself. So that's sort of what's happening in one of those societies is that you do something I regard as violating my rights. You kill one of my sons, say. I then go through some procedure designed to get you into the legal system and to make you pay damages for doing that. If that isn't working, then I and my allies threaten to use force against you. And if it's a well-functioning system, you don't have allies because other people around realize that you're in the wrong, or you don't have very many allies, and therefore usually you back down, or usually I win. So it's not those societies have money, but the money isn't the major element of how they're coordinating that sort of thing. Now, the money does come in, at least in the Icelandic system, and I think also in the Somali system, in damage payments. So that I wrong you, and the settlement may well be that I have to pay you a certain amount of money. And there's a famous scene in Njalsaga, sequence of scenes, where you have two men who are close friends, their wives hate each other, and the wives have been organizing, getting members of the household to kill members of the other household back and forth. That is, they get A to kill B, then the other person gets C to kill A, and so forth. And you get, I don't know, maybe four or six people killed in the course of this. And the two husbands are passing a purse of silver back and forth, paying damages for the killings that their wives are responsible for. It's sort of a bizarre sequence, and we don't know if it really happened or not, though it's certainly part of an interesting story. So you do have money payments of that sort. And on the whole, money payments seem like they usually make more sense than jail sentences, since jail sentence, somebody's got to pay for the jail and the victim doesn't get anything. And of course, our tort system has money payments as well. It's just one way of describing the Icelandic system is to say that tort law has swallowed criminal law. That is to say that that's not really historically right, because tort law in a certain sense was invented long after that. But in our terms, that's what's happening. But it's privately enforced tort law, not. And there are criminal punishments in our sense, in the sense that if you kill somebody and the case doesn't settle out of court, you eventually end up getting outlawed. And when you're outlawed, it's legal to kill you and illegal for anybody to protect you. So there is, in effect, capital punishment, but capital punishment only when the negotiation system breaks down. Whereas in our system, when we have capital punishment, if you kill somebody, it's the state that decides to execute you, not the close relative of the victim, who would be the person who would be handling it in the Icelandic system. But I think you see one of the things I found interesting is you see what looked to me like fossilized remnants of this system in a variety of other legal systems. So, for example, I have a discussion with regard to Jewish law, where Jewish law, as of the time we know it, is not really a feud system. But Jewish law has features which look an awful lot as though it evolved out of that kind of system. And I think that's probably true of Roman law, though I don't think we'd have as clear an idea of how the early parts of that worked. It's clearly true of our law because our legal system is Anglo-American common law, which came out ultimately of Anglo-Saxon law. And if you look at the Anglo-Saxon law before its last century or so, it looks an awful lot like the Icelandic system, although it's not as pure a case because there is a king, whereas Iceland had no king, had no formal ruler at all. Now, I should say, I don't want listeners to get misled. The book is not all about this kind of system. The book discusses, I think, about 13, I think, different legal systems, of which the Somali and the Icelandic are really the only ones that I would describe as, in some sense, purely stateless systems. The Irish law clearly has a stateless element, but unfortunately, we don't have good enough sources of how it worked initially to be sure how much of it was stateless and how much wasn't. And then you've got a number of things like the Amish and the Romani, where what you really have is a stateless system underneath a state. That is, you have what I refer to as an embedded legal system, where you've got a group of people who have mechanisms for settling their disputes themselves, but are at least nominally ruled by a state over them. Basically, the Amish policy is that if the state wants to make them do something they really disapprove of, they engage in passive resistance. So the Amish were not willing to pay Social Security, for example, or to send their kids to public schools. And in both of those, they eventually got their way. I think the U.S. may be the only place where there is still Amish. There may still be some in Canada. There are none left in Europe. And I think part of the reason is that for whatever reason, the U.S. was actually quite tolerant with regard to them. And so the U.S. government eventually backed down on Social Security and agreed that Amish did not have to either pay or receive Social Security, except, I think, for Amish employees of non-Amish employers, where I think they still pay it. And similarly, there was eventually a Supreme Court verdict in their favor on schooling, which held that they could take their kids out of school, I think after eighth grade, if I remember correctly, and in effect homeschool them thereafter. And at the state level, the Amish have in practice been allowed to run their own schools for those first eighth grades, and those schools are not schools that would be acceptable if anybody else was running them, because the teachers don't have certification and such, being themselves Amish who've only gone to eighth grade. But the system works, as far as you can tell. It seems to be quite a well-functioning community. But anyway, I was just going to go back and say that a majority of the systems I discuss, Roman law, I discuss Jewish law, I discuss Islamic law, I discuss the legal system of Periclean Athens, a whole bunch of interesting ones. So that my project is not a book about stateless systems. This is a book about a bunch of interestingly different legal systems, where my basic assumption is that all human societies face about the same problems. They solve them in an interesting variety of different ways, and they're all grown-ups. That you ought to take all of them seriously, as this is one way in which these problems could be solved. Let's see what interesting ideas they have, what problems they encountered, and so forth. I'm not trying to deduce the perfect legal system. I doubt there is one. It probably depends on the various features of the environment it's functioning in. I don't, for example, assume that a stateless system will work in all possible environments. I've just been having an email correspondence with somebody in Armenia who pretty clearly has generally libertarian instincts, but is worried about how Armenia with Turkey on one border and Azerbaijan on the other, and neither of them its friend, could survive without a government. My answer, I don't know if it could or not. Maybe it couldn't. I should also say that there are two chapters in that book I didn't write. I got two people I knew who had written interesting books to do essentially chapter length versions of those books. And one of them is Peter Leeson's chapter on 18th century pirates, which turns out to be an interesting legal system, the system that the pirate ships used for themselves. And the other one is David Scarbeck on prison gangs, which again is quite a fascinating story of what's essentially a legal system that has arisen spontaneously within prisons. And those are both quite interesting chapters. Each of them had written an interesting book. They're interesting people. But anyway, it's not mainly about stateless ones. But what I did find interesting in the sort of the research that led to it was that when I wrote my first book nearly 50 years ago, one of the things I was doing in that book was inventing an imaginary modern version of a stateless society. And I concluded with all the stuff I did on this book that I was really reinventing the wheel, because less elaborate versions had in fact existed in the real world, 1,000 years before, more or less. I should say, with regard to how common it is, I've got a quote in one of the chapters from a medieval historian, and he's really describing what I think of as feud society as the normal arrangement of the early Middle Ages, that you had a king nominally, but what normally happened was that somebody aggressed against somebody else, where the victim might be seen as a family, a monastery, some group. It was generally accepted that the victims could then, as it were, charge the aggressors, ask for compensation. If they didn't get compensation, they could use force against the aggressors. And everybody else would say, that's all right. That's what's supposed to happen. So in that sense, he's suggesting that really the main system in medieval Europe, at least for a fair while, was that, whereas even though you had a nominal system of a king and courts and laws and so forth over them. Now, I'm not a medieval historian, so I don't know how controversial that reading of it is, but I thought it was quite an interesting passage, so I quoted it. Lots of them interesting. I guess the one I start with is Imperial China, which is certainly not a stateless society by any means, but Imperial China had a more or less continuous functioning legal system for more than 2,000 years. There were breaks, you had breakdowns, and then a new dynasty would come up. But as far as we can tell, the legal code of the last dynasty contained noticeable amounts of stuff from the Han dynasty, which was not quite the first, but the first one to unite China didn't last very long, and Han was its successor. So Han dynasty roughly is contemporary with the Roman Republic, Roman Empire. So starting something like 300 BC, and it only collapsed at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, roughly. So that's one of the really interesting ones in a whole bunch of ways. We get things from them. The whole civil service exam system is Chinese. That's where we borrowed that particular system from, as far as I can tell. And it's, in a sense, one of the oddest features of that system, which was that the procedure for becoming an important official involved passing extraordinarily selective tests, which were not about how to be an official. They were about whether you were an educated, cultured gentleman who could improvise poetry and had beautiful handwriting and was really expert in the Confucian classics. And the second level of exams had a pass rate of somewhere around 1%. The third and highest level, I think, was not much higher than that. It was the sort of thing where somebody who got through the whole thing probably had spent his lifetime studying for it and made it through sometime in his 30s. Why in the world did they have such a system for selecting what was basically the ruling bureaucrats, which is what it was? And I then argue that, in fact, that system is alive and well in America. It's not quite as extreme a version. But if you think about the fact that if you want to get most respectable jobs, you first have to go to college, even though most of what you're, depending on your field, but in many contexts, most of what you're studying in college has nothing to do with the job you're going to have. So it's, again, somehow a filter, which is filtering people theoretically for being sort of educated, civilized, cultured gentlemen, rather than for knowing the things that you would think they had to know for the job. So it's the reason for their doing it. Let me switch my background effect. So it's just what's actually in my office instead of what you're seeing, just sort of irrelevant. That's a background effect I use for other things. So anyway, that was sort of interesting. And lots of other things. I argue that there are some features of some of these legal systems that we might usefully borrow. There are some features where a feature of the Periclean Athenian legal system is echoed in the way modern Americans run some horse races. That's sort of one of my favorite examples that somebody pointed out, that the problem, one of the issues for a legal system, at least a state legal system, is how do you pay for public goods? How do you get somebody to fund the Navy for Athens and other things? And the Athenians had their own solution to that problem. It's sort of a weird system. In their system, if you were one of the richest Athenians, every other year you had to fund a public good. And some magistrate would come up to you and say, you see that beautiful trireme down on the deck? Guess who's paying her bills this year? Or you've heard that we're sending a team to the Olympics this year for the glory of Athens. Congratulations, you're the sponsor. And the problem, if you think about it, is how do you find out who are the richest people in Athens? All right. The basic rule was that if you wanted to get out of one of these things, you had to either show that you did one last year, or that you were already doing one this year, or that there was somebody else who was richer than you were, who hadn't done one last year and wasn't doing one this year, and therefore you could transfer it to him. And the question was, how in a society without accountants and IRS and all the rest of that stuff, how do you prove that somebody's richer than you are? Right? And they had a lovely answer. It was an economist's answer. And the answer is that you offer to trade everything you own for everything he owns. And if he turns you down, he's admitted he's richer than you are. Well, it turns out that that's the way what's called a claiming race is done in modern day America. That is the same principle. And the problem is you would like to have a race in which all the horses are about equally good. And if you say to people, we want, you know, level X horses, there's an obvious incentive for somebody to enter an X plus one horse in order to win the race. So what you say instead is, if you enter this race, you are agreeing to sell your horse for $5,000 to anybody who wants to buy it. Well, you could win the race really easily by putting in a really good horse, but it would be a $15,000 horse you'd be selling for $5,000. So that's exactly the same principle of self-revealing action applied in Athens more than 2,000 years ago and today in America, although in one case it was part of the political system, in the other case a private arrangement. So a lot of that sort of stuff is just fun looking at it. And to take another example, a problem that lots of legal systems have is if you question somebody under torture, how do you know if he's telling the truth? All right. That in Athenian law and in Roman law, I believe, slaves could only be questioned under torture. And I assume what's going on, though I don't know, is that you mostly want to question a slave to get information on his owner, because the slave is likely to observe things the owner did. The owner is in a position to punish the slave afterwards or to make the slave's life miserable in one way or another. So you need some countervailing pressure to make the slave tell the truth. That's my theory. I don't know if it's right or not. But we know that the Athenians argued about the question that you have. One of our main sources for Athenian law are the speeches that a professional orator would write for a party to a law case to memorize and deliver, because you didn't have lawyers, but you had to represent yourself, but you could represent yourself with words somebody else had taught you. And it happens that we have one oration which is on the question of whether slaves can be trusted. Slave testimony under torture can be trusted. And the author of that oration says, absolutely, they can perfectly well be trusted. There has never been a case in the history of Athens where such testimony found to be false. We have another oration in which the orator says, no, of course they can't be trusted. They'll say whatever the torturer wants them to say. They were written by the same orator for different clients. But we also have a solution to this problem in about 800 years later or so, in Ostrogothic law. This is Ostrogothic Spain before the Muslims conquered Spain. And in their law code, the rule was that if somebody was accused of something really serious and the judge couldn't find enough evidence to either convict or acquit, they didn't have our view, if you can't convict, you have to acquit, that he's allowed to torture him, but he can only torture him if there is something that the interrogator knows that a guilty person would know and an innocent person wouldn't know, some fact about the crime. And if you have that, then you stop torturing him when either you decide he's innocent or he tells you that thing that's showing he's guilty. All right. And in theory, at least, you can't torture him unless you have some such piece of information. Now, we use the same method, and it's got the same problem, of course, that when we try to pressure somebody to confess, one of the evidences that he's really confessed rather than being pressured, either literally beaten up, which police have been known to do, or other things short of that, is that he tells you things like details of the crime that he otherwise wouldn't know. And of course, the problem with our system, and I suspect with their system, is it works just fine if the interrogator is honest. But if the interrogator isn't honest, he knows the fact, so he feeds the fact to the guy. The guy's being tortured, so he feeds the fact back, and now you just don't tell anybody that you fed him the fact. So I just thought it was an interesting kind of parallelism of the same issues arising. I just found it quite a lot of fun. The way I got into this book originally was that a very long time ago, I got interested in the legal system of saga period Iceland. And that, other than my having read some of the sagas, I got interested in that because of a controversy among two pairs of scholars at University of Chicago, Gary Becker and George Stigler, both of whom eventually got Nobel Prizes in economics, and Richard Posner and Bill Landis. Posner was a federal appeals court judge, and they were both very prominent law school, law and econ scholars. And it was an argument over the possibility of switching our criminal system to a system where instead of having police be employees paid a salary, the criminal pays a fine and the policeman collects the fine. And the original Becker-Stigler argument was, look, the present system is not incentive compatible because, after all, I've got the goods on you. The punishment is the equivalent to you of a $100,000 fine. The reward to me in our system for catching you is a gold star on my report card, that my reputation as a cop goes up a bit and I make more $10,000 more in my lifetime. And according to Dragnet, we know what happens. I take the evidence to the DA and you get prosecuted. According to economics, we know what happens too. Markets exist to move resources to their highest valued use. So the criminal pays off the cop and the cop burns the evidence. And that means that in order for the system to work, you need a second layer of cops watching the first layer and maybe a third layer watching the second. It's not that it's impossible, but it makes it much harder. And Becker and Stigler said, look, if I collect the $100,000 you pay, the problem disappears. And Landis and Posner pointed out a number of problems with that and suggested that after you finished dealing with those problems, what Becker and Stigler had really done was to reinvent tort law. Because in tort law, after all, the victim has a claim against the tortfeasor. It is up to the victim to get that claim vindicated in the court, and then the tortfeasor's damage payment goes to the victim. And I got interested in that, and I was interested in part because I thought I knew about a real world system that worked that way, namely Saga Period Iceland. And I ended up writing two different journal articles for journals published at Chicago, one of which was an attempt to understand the Icelandic system of 1,000 years ago, and the other of which was a purely theoretical article showing that what Landis and Posner thought was an insoluble problem with the proposal was not in fact insoluble. There was a simple and elegant way of solving the problem they had raised. And those were both published. And the result was that Landis and Posner invited me to come to Chicago to argue with them at shorter range. And I ended up spending 8 or 10 years as a faculty fellow at the Chicago Law School as a result of that. So that's really the point at which I switched from doing other kinds of economics to doing economic analysis of law. But anyway, so I did the article on Iceland, and it was a fun article, and I learned lots of neat stuff and thought it was really interesting. And then I was lazy. And eventually I got interested in another legal system, which was the legal system, the criminal law of 18th century England. Because 18th century England on paper is our legal system. The only thing is there are no police or public prosecutors. I slightly exaggerate. There are public prosecutors if you actually commit a crime against the crown, if you, you know, steal money from the treasury or something. But for practical purposes, there are no public prosecutors. So it was a system in which the law was made and enforced by the state, but the whole prosecution process, the process by which you figured out who's guilty and prove he's guilty, was entirely private, responsibility of the victim. And so how did that work? And that was really interesting. And I ended up writing an article on that. And again, I thought it was a fun article. I learned lots of interesting stuff, some of it relevant to modern societies. And then I was lazy for a long time. And I said to myself, eventually, I should stop being lazy. But I'm lazy by nature. How can I make myself get some work done? So there was a solution to that. I announced that the next year I was teaching a seminar on legal systems very different from ours. Well, I had two of them. I needed some more. So I went to our nice librarians and I said, can you find me books describing legal systems other than ours? And they presented me with one of these rolling bookcases, I think maybe 2 or 3 shelves high, filled with books. And I went through the books and I ended up finding enough to do a seminar. And I did that seminar every other year for, I suppose, about 10 or 12 years. And I got some additional information from my students because the students in the seminar were writing papers, and almost all of the papers consisted of a description of some legal system that I hadn't covered and that they had investigated. And that was a lot of fun. It was interesting sort of what they did. One of my favorite cases was I had a student who was a sort of a tall, very Anglo-looking fellow. And so I was asking them at the beginning of the seminar, you know, do you have any special sources of information that would suggest a legal system? And he said, well, I do speak Vietnamese. And I was a little surprised that, you know, how do you happen to be to speak Vietnamese? Well, he was a Mormon and he said he'd been a missionary. And I said, oh, in Vietnam? He said, no, Los Angeles. But he did me a reasonably interesting paper on the traditional legal system of Vietnam. And the last year I took it, which was particularly fun, most of my class consisted of Saudi LLM students. The LLM is people who've gotten there, who've been through 3 years of law school and they want to get a little bit more, basically. I don't know why they were there. But they were almost all Saudis. Saudi Arabia was more or less the closest thing that exists in the modern world to Islamic law. To real Islamic law, traditional Islamic law. Most of the Muslim states talk a whole lot about Sharia, but that's not really what they have. What they really have are bits and pieces of the traditional system pasted into a modern legal system. But the traditional Islamic law was not made by the state. Traditional Islamic law was discovered by scholars from religious sources, and the state appointed the judges, but the judges were supposed to either be expert in the religious sources or consult. So that was an interesting system. But now I had a whole classroom full of people who had lived in something at least not too far from that system, so I could get information from them. And it turned out that there was a particular institution which my very high status modern secondary sources claimed had become extinct centuries ago. And said, oh, no, it's not extinct. All of us are part of one of those. A form of clustering which was originally tribes, probably, which had legal consequences. It has not just legal consequences, it determines who you can marry in that system, because it's an endogamous system in which you only marry, in effect, within your own tribe. So that was really, really neat and was fun. Anyway, that was the last year before I retired. So my basic point is that the book really came out of this experience. It came out of the combination of what I learned in order to teach to them and what they learned and taught me in the course of doing their papers. That was quite a lot of fun.
Excellent. The book is Legal Systems, Very Different from Ours. I am going to turn things over to my colleague at the Libertarian Institute and Liberty Weekly. He is a practicing attorney. Patrick, take it over for me.
Hey, everybody. That's right. Before you get into my interview with David D. Friedman, I'm going to start the portion of the show where I tell you how you can support this content. If you appreciate it, please head over to libertyweekly.net/support. All the links are going to be there. No more of me reading off so many different /links for you to go. Just go to libertyweekly.net/support. There you can find the Patreon link. You can find the Subscribestar link. You can also find the link to float.app, where you can support my content at a discount for cryptocurrency. That is the preferred way to support this content. I have started a new thing where I'm going to be doing a live hangout with Patreon supporters where I'm on the call, you're on the call. We're recording a podcast that we'll release in the Liberty Bigly feed, and it'll be a lot of fun. So the first one is starting this Friday at 8 p.m. Central Time. I'll be sending out the link to everyone. It will be for Patreon supporters and Subscribestar supporters at the $5 a month level. But for float.app supporters for crypto, it'll be available for $3 per month. So really looking forward to meeting some of you guys, hoping that a lot of people show up, and it will be a lot of fun. Next up, I've been tearing it up on Substack, so you can go over there and subscribe to my columns via email. Everything is free for now. I don't know if that'll change. It might change for bigger works. We'll see. But go check out Substack. I've been releasing articles that have been getting very good reception on social media. As well, I have a shout out. There's a new Patreon supporter, and that is Youper. Youper, I don't know, maybe you're from Northern Michigan. I think that we'll talk in the Discord channel. By the way, if you want to hang out in the Discord channel, that's libertyweekly.net/Discord. As well, there are non-monetary ways to support this content. That is by subscribing, rating, and reviewing, and sharing with your friends. Really do appreciate it. By the way, if you like this topic of alternative legal systems, I covered this in depth on libertyweekly.net/36, the 36th episode of the show. I consider it a classic, one of my favorites, so go check that one out. Okay, without further ado, here's my interview with David D. Friedman. Hey, Professor Friedman, I just wanted to thank you for being so generous with your time with us. Just dovetailing off of what Keith had asked about, have you viewed that there's a lack of scholarship in the area of studying comparative legal systems?
There certainly is a literature on comparative legal systems, but I think most of it goes into comparing what, from my standpoint, are versions of the same legal system. That is, if you look at it relative to imperial Chinese law or Periclean Athenian law, American law, Japanese law, and German law are not that different. They're somewhat different. The German law is theoretically coming out of some mix of Roman and Code Napoleon stuff, and the American law is coming out of ultimately English common law and Anglo-Saxon law originally. But nowadays in the modern world, they've got an awful lot more in common than difference. And I don't think that there is very much done of what I was doing. There's certainly some of it. I ended up, the book doesn't have anything on Roman law, but I did do a chapter on Roman law for somebody else's book. And it was clear there that there was just an immense scholarship. And I was trying to look at a particular kind of question. And I think I said some things about it might have been true, but I really felt like sort of a novice in this sea of stuff by people, all of whom were fluent in Latin, whereas my Latin is terrible. And who knew a whole lot more about the details and the very large textual stuff that survived from most of the empire. We don't have that much from the Republic. And so I think there are particular areas where people have done quite a lot. But as far as I could tell, for Somali law, until pretty recently, there was really one source. one person, a London School of Economics anthropologist who had been studying it since the late 50s. And I corresponded with him. And I basically had some questions for him. And he basically, rather than answering my questions, says the answer is in this book of mine. And I found the book, and it was. And that was really interesting. And since then, my friend Peter Leeson has written about Somalia, and I've written about it. I'm sure there are a few other people who have, but I don't think there's been much on that legal system. And similarly, there have been some libertarians who have written on the early Irish system, and maybe I should look at more of what they've got. But I was, what I was going by was basically the work by a modern high-level scholar of early Irish legal history. And I concluded from that that it was an interesting system, but it was hard to be really sure what was going on because we've got fragmentary sources. They don't seem to agree with each other. We aren't sure whether the disagreement is changes over time or changes over space or different people wanting to accent different things or maybe even distortions in transmission because you're talking about what something like 9th century sources that survive in 14th century or 15th century or 16th century sources. But I don't think, I haven't at least come across anything that's very much like what I was doing. It was sort of taking a bunch of very different systems. And again, there's certainly a lot of stuff on Jewish law and a noticeable amount on Islamic law, though at least in English, maybe not that much. And also, of course, the people who wrote most of those things were economists, and that gives you a particular angle for trying to make sense of things, which I think is at least occasionally an informative one. So no, there certainly is stuff, but in general, I write more than I read. That is to say, it's not literally true. I read a lot of books for this, but I tend not to get into the very common scholarly pattern of here is a area of research in my field. I'll read everything in that and then try to contribute to it. That I try rather to say, here's something I'm interested in. What can I learn about something I'm interested in? What I can write? What can I write about it? And it's at least quite likely maybe some other crazy person 30 years ago did something similar. I've had that experience at least once. But it's not, you know, this is my little bit added to the literature in the field. I've sometimes said in the context of economics that there are basically two different approaches to economic research, which I identify with the intensive and extensive margin. And those are that's terminology Ricardo used with regard to agriculture. And the intensive margin consists of trying to grow more grain on the fields you're already growing grain in. And the extensive margin is bringing new land under cultivation. And in economics, I like to say the intensive margin is trying to say something new about a question that smart people have been talking about for 100 years. The extensive margin is finding some place where your ideas can be applied and haven't been. And I would take of the modern people, Peter Leeson would probably be my favorite example of someone who now works the extensive margin, not just pirates. He's done a variety of other things. That's what Gary Becker did. Gary Becker did it with both the family and with crime. Economic analysis of. That's what Jim Buchanan and Gordon Tullock did with public choice theory. And I just find that more exciting and more interesting and on the whole more productive. A long time ago, I was at UCLA and I didn't have tenure and I didn't get tenure. And I had a conversation with the chairman of the department and he said, look, you're a bright guy. If you followed the journals and wrote articles on whatever with current hot topic, you'd get the kind of record that would get you tenure at a place like UCLA. And I said, yeah, probably would. If you were me, would you do that? And he said, no. That was Lamer, I think, was the person as I remember involved. I just remember that incident. And I think that's right. And it's, and you know, I prefer the policy that I follow. It's more fun and more interesting.
Oh, I'm sure it is. And
you had another question though.
Do you think that a legal system is something that a society can intentionally adopt? And I'm thinking about, you know, the reasons why that we're comparing different legal systems ostensibly is to try and figure out how we can improve our own system. But yes. When you're talking about such fundamental changes.
Yes.
So
I think the answer in practice most of the time is that most of your legal system you inherit from the past, but you can make changes. So that the U.S., for example, adopted no-fault divorce in various states. The U.S. stopped enforcing damages for breach of contract to marry. And there have been various changes, and often the changes are driven by somebody or some group of people who say, look, this is clearly a better way of doing it. They may be wrong, of course, but I think that's what happened. So I think you can do that. And maybe over an extended period of time, you could have changes that really mattered. That, for example, I've seen it argued that in theory, the U.S. basically abandoned freedom of contract over the last century. So that if I make a product and I only sell it to people who promise not to sue me if it goes wrong, that's not going to be an enforceable agreement in practice. However, I gather that to some extent, that's been reversed by making arbitration agreements enforceable. That is to say that in at least some contexts, there are contracts you could not write and have enforceable under the legal system, but you can by agreeing to arbitration with those as part of the terms of the agreement. So that would be a case where you might be able to work around, as it were, and get de facto. And similarly, after all, our whole criminal system is a fraud. That is to say, the formal description of our criminal system, that people get a trial by their jury. Well, for felons, that's true of what, 2% of all felons?
Yeah.
That virtually all felony cases are settled by plea bargains. Maybe that may be a good or a bad thing. You can argue about that. But that's a case where there was never a point at which people said, oops, sorry, trial by jury doesn't work. Let's switch to something else. But given the difficulties of giving everybody a trial by jury, there was clearly a pressure to maintain a way around it, as it were. And that developed to the point where the exception swallowed the rule, so to speak. So that would be sort of an interesting case to me, where you really had quite a large change in the system, which happened, I think, not really. There probably were some people who argued for it, but not really designed. But mostly, I mean, I'm not really an engineer. I'm really interested in understanding things, and I will leave it to other people to hopefully use some of that understanding in making the world a better place.
Do you have an opinion on whether or not the most meaningful change comes from a positive law situation or from bubbling up through the common law, you know, organic interactions on the marketplace, so to speak?
I don't think I know enough to answer that kind of question.
Yeah.
And it's sort of unclear to what extent political changes aren't really organic too, in the sense they come from changes in ideas. I was thinking about that in an entirely different context. There's, as you may know, there used to be a blog called Slate Star Codex by a guy called Scott Alexander, a very interesting blog that I spent a lot of time on. And it's now been revived under a different name but with the same person doing it. And he had an exchange recently with somebody on the question of whether certain approaches to improving the world were good or not. And it was sort of trying to distinguish between experts figuring out what the right rule was and imposing it, and somehow having something evolve up from below. But it was pretty fuzzy what the argument was about. But it occurred to me to think about a real world example, because it was one that came up in what they were discussing, although they were discussing it now and not originally. And that's the auctioning off of the airwaves. All right. The idea, the standard system for the airwaves for a long time, was that a government regulatory agency decides which radio broadcasts are broadcasting in the public interest, and they give them the right to broadcast. And Ronald Coase suggested, God, it must by now be 60 years ago or something like that, that it would make much more sense to simply auction off the spectrum, that it's true it's a scarce resource, but the way we usually handle scarce resources is not government allocation, it's market allocation. And at the time, it was obviously a crazy idea nobody would ever do. It's not what they do. But the question was, when they finally did it, does that count as the experts from above saying, aha, here's this clever idea, let's impose it on the system? Or does that count on Ronald Coase 60 years ago having said, let's put an idea into the stream, as it were, that idea will work its way organically through the economics profession because it's an idea that is obviously the right idea to any really good economist. And eventually, lo and behold, it gets practiced. So it's not always a clear distinction what you count as sort of top-down versus organic. And similarly, if you think about this whole wokeism nonsense at present, that's organic in the sense that somehow this weird new religion spread through the society and got a very powerful position. But it's inorganic in as much as it then says, all right, we'll hit you over the head if you say the wrong things, in effect, or fire you or do something to you. Other questions?
Yeah, well, that's really interesting. But just to make a comment on that, one of the reasons I asked is because I've done some studying. I think in my second year in law school, I did some studying on customary legal systems. And one of the big things that comes up is that, well, in I guess what we would call the less developed world, folks can't rely on the government to enforce any kind of legal system. So it comes up that they create, you know, a lot of it's community-based. Well, whether you have a tribe of elders or anything like that, just as a matter of circumstance, that's how
it comes up. But, of course, that's the situation inside an American prison, too.
Yeah.
You're inside an American prison. You'd like to buy some heroin from another prisoner who's gotten it smuggled in. And for some reason, the prison guards aren't willing to enforce the contract by which you agree to pay for him next week. And so they developed their own mechanisms for enforcing those rules. I mean, that's part of what's fascinating about David Skarbek's book, describing that mechanism. And of course, a lot of stuff in a modern society, a lot of stuff is in practice enforced by norms, not by laws. So that's really privately enforced by forms of social pressure. I like to say that there is no legal rule that would prevent me from teaching a class naked to the waist. But it would be a stupid thing to do because it would have negative effects on my reputation. And then you think about how norms change, and I like to specify the hypothetical, but not actually hypothetical, example of a brave professor who teaches his class in t-shirt and cut-off shorts and whatever you kind of call the things you wear instead of shoes that are, rubber sandal kinds of things. And he gets away with it. And after a while, maybe some other people start doing it. That's how norms change. And that's a friend of mine at George Mason who behaves that way. Now, it helps that he's also a very productive academic, therefore can get away with things like that. So norms do sometimes change in interesting ways.
Have you ever found that folks and other academics or maybe jurists would scoff at the idea that we could learn something from, you know, quote unquote, more primitive legal systems?
No, that is, there may well be people who think that. But I would guess that if anything, the sort of academic biases are going the other way, that, you know, you're supposed to respect diversity and stuff like that. And in practice, respect for diversity tends to be limited to rather specific kinds of diversity that you like. But nonetheless, I think somebody might well object to a particular example and think it was a bad system. But I don't think that the general idea of saying you could learn things from other cultures, that sort of sounds, you know, touchy-feely, modern kind of fashionable views. But I think it's also true that you can. That, I mean, there are enough really smart people in the past so that even though we've got this puzzle about why IQ scores have gradually crept over time, I don't think it's believable that the reason those systems existed was because all the people who did them were too stupid. Then I think, you know, that some of them maybe were stupid, but I think I like to describe the Athenian system as the legal system of a mad economist, because it's sort of got multiple ideas which might or may not work but are clever ideas, such as the way of finding out whether somebody's richer than you are. And there are other examples of that in that legal system. They had very elaborate mechanisms for making sure that a juror never knew which case he was going to be on until the last minute in order to keep people from bribing the jurors, for example. And they did other interesting things. And I'm not particularly an admirer of saga period Iceland or for that matter of Imperial China, but all of them are human beings doing interesting things, and I want to understand them.
And I think maybe some of the hubris of libertarian theorists is that we're always trying to look to the past and say, because a big objection to a stateless society or the feasibility of it is like, okay, well, point to when in the past we had a society that existed without government. And so what you try to do is, at least from my perspective, when I was a 2L in law school, I was trying to look to find here, aha, I found it. You know, this is the point where anarcho-capitalism existed. However, a lot of times people will say, well, you know, why don't you move to Somalia? Because that's an anarchic system and it was a disaster, which we have scholarship that kind of underlines maybe the opposite. So they'll say, oh, well, why would you want to emulate Somalia?
You know? But the answer, of course, is there are a whole lot of differences. And Somalia is a great deal poorer than we are. And they speak a language you don't know. And even that is in the case of Somalia, as you probably know, the mess came when England and Italy set up a centralized democratic government for a society that never had such a thing. But even when it was functioning tolerably well, it was still not nearly as nice a place to live as America is at the moment for lots of different reasons. I think people mostly don't appreciate just how much better off we are, we being the developed world in general, not a particular part of it, that the figure that McCloskey gives somewhere, which I think is right, is that the average real income of the developed world at present is 20 to 30 times what it was through most of history for the world as a whole. And I think for the globe as a whole, it's maybe 10 times, something like that. You know, given a very poor society, it's not at all clear that a modern set of institutions would have lasted for a month in that society. I mean, putting people in jail, unless you're going to work them in jail, is awfully expensive if that means somebody else is starving to death, which it very likely would. So that imprisonment is not a very common pattern in past societies, much less common than in modern societies. And when you do have imprisonment, it's likely to be things like galley slaves, where you're actually using them as labor and not just locking them up and feeding them, which is what we mostly do. It's very hard to say that in their society, in their circumstances, you could just have come down. Let me go back to something else that Ronald Coase did. Coase's last work, which would have been finished when he was close to 100, he's no longer alive, unfortunately, was a book he co-authored with a Chinese economist on how China went capitalist. And as I read the book, one of the lessons he draws was that China did better with what they did, which was a sort of a trial and error blundering into the system, than if they had hired economists from America, whether from Chicago or Harvard, and done what they told them, because they had to deal with their society and its existing institutions and beliefs and all the rest of it. And the result is that China did much better than Russia or any of the Eastern European countries, except those that had become communist late enough so they still remember it, like Czechia, for example, what a capitalist society was like. But I think that the other ones have not done as well as China did, relatively speaking, and that now it's not doing as well now. And unfortunately, Deng's no longer around sort of with a hand on things. But at least by Coase's account, it wasn't that the Chinese government said, here's what we would do. It's that the Chinese government said, we don't know what to do. So when people do things, don't stomp on them. And if they do things and they work, let them keep doing it. And if they keep working, maybe encourage them. And that's how you got a semi-privatization of agriculture. That's how you got a lot of small firms in the cities and a bunch of other things happening. So it's a very interesting book. I would recommend the Kosen Wang, Ning Wang, I think is his name, book on how China went capitalist.
The book is Legal Systems, Very Different from Ours. Mr. Friedman, thank you so much for your time. Is the best place to find your work, daviddfriedman.com?
Yes. DavidDFriedman.com is my homepage. It has links to full text of some of my books, most of my articles. It has a link to my blog, which has got 15 years of essays on a very wide variety of subjects. And so that ought to be useful.
Mr. Friedman, thank you so much for your time. And thank you to everyone for watching Keith Knight, Don't Tread on Anyone and the Liberty Weekly podcast.
Thank you. I enjoyed it. Bye-bye.
Thanks so much.
Take care, Mr. Friedman. We appreciate it as always.
And you.